This episode, I'm joined once again by Valentin Jalier to discuss the work of William Blake. I'd like to say a big thank you to my paying patrons and subscribers for making all of this work possible. And if you'd like to support the podcast and keep everything running, please find links in the description below. Otherwise, please enjoy. So, Valentin Jalier, thanks very much once again for joining us on Hermetics Podcast.
It's a great pleasure. I'm really enjoying the podcast, James.
Thanks very much. So, after our last discussion on Shakespeare, we sort of had a chat after it finished, and we were talking about other people that came up, maybe we could talk about, and one was William Blake, who people have asked for an episode on Blake before. And in a way, it's difficult because we could say that a bit large percentage of Blake's work in its sensual way, like I can't really do anything about because it's visual. So maybe if you're listening to this, go type William Blake art into Google Images and look at them while you're listening. So that's something we can't really cover, of course. But we can cover his poetry and his prose and his writings. And I guess just to begin, I mean, he's one of the more well-known writers that I'll be tackling on the podcast. But where did your interest in Blake begin? And I mean, it seems almost like a silly question with such a big figure, but who is this guy? I would even say that, like, he's a name, right? But not like you'd know the name, but you might actually not have ever really come across his work. I'm not going to say he's forgotten. I'm not going to say he's overlooked, but he doesn't slip in as much as it appears. I mean, you know, I guess to say before beginning the discussion, I'd never read any Blake. So you recommended David Cayley's podcasts as like an introduction to the context of Blake. And then I picked up a collected writings book actually. And then you recommended like some of the classics. And then I just went away and read some other stuff.
Yeah. Well, it's I think even those of us, I mean, even those who would claim to be perhaps a little further alongside the path of expertise would still say they find it difficult to approach Blake because there are so many Blakes. There's the Blake that, you know, school children might know in the form of, you know, popular poems like, you know, The Tiger or The Lamb or poetry that is gathered in the Songs of Innocence and of Experience. And you study those at English GCSE, you know? So there's a very popular face of Blake. There's the Blake that you hear in church or, you know, at a football game or cricket, where people sing the words of the hymn Jerusalem, perhaps sometimes without really understanding what those words are saying. But then at the same time, there's the incredible work that he did as an engraver and as a painter. And then there are these fantastical prophetic books, which are, you know, which probably would be worth an episode at least all to themselves, because that's where Blake really develops his whole kind of moving dynamic mythology, which is extraordinarily complex and lucid all at once. So maybe for today, I'm going to sort of limit myself to very general comments about that and slightly focus on the earlier Blake of Innocence of Experience and Marriage of Heaven and Hell and the like. But my own interest really is because when I was kind of a schoolboy myself, maybe about 14 or 15, someone read to me these four lines of Blake, Eternity, he who binds to himself a joy, does the winged life destroy, but he who kisses the joy as it flies lives in eternity's sunrise. And at that point, I was really already very interested in Eastern philosophy and things of that sort. And this was the first sort of Western voice that I heard speaking that way. And I thought, okay, I don't know who this guy is, but he knows something. He knows something. So that original... those original four lines about eternity really stayed with me. And I knew that I was going to have to deal with Blake and encounter him at some point in my life. It just kept saying, not yet, not yet, not yet. And it seems like now that I'm teaching him and writing about him, the time has finally come. But he's been with me all these years also through another thing that happened early on in my life is walking through London, falling in love with London. And he was really a fellow Londoner, someone who could experience what I was experiencing in London, just walking, or often in a kind of half daze, a sense in which my everyday vision and my imagination were sort of interweaving.
Mm-hmm.
And I was having these extraordinary walks and these extraordinary experiences in London. And I started to re-encounter some of Blake's poetry and his own, you know, he's a poet of the city. He's spent most of his life in London, except for a couple of years. And suddenly I realized that there was a fellow traveler, you know, there was a fellow sort of mystic London dweller. So those are the two ways in which I kind of encountered Blake kind of really early on in my life. And yeah, stayed with me ever since.
Well, I certainly can't relate to falling in love with London. I've never done that. But but I can relate, you know, as I said, this is my first time reading Blake. And actually, I just realized the first time I would have actually come across Blake in any like serious appropriation of his work would actually be the film Hannibal, where the guy eats. Have you seen it?
No.
So he goes to, in the film Hannibal, the villain of, the other villain of the film goes right. He's obsessed with William Blake and he goes and literally eats one of his paintings in a sort of Blakean fit of, I guess, like energetic ecstasy. But he's sort of a villainous Blakean. But that was actually, I just realized that was probably my first like, oh, maybe I won't read Blake. But there you go. But it's interesting when now I'm first reading him. For myself, this notion that you had of like you're interested in Eastern writing, and then you read Blake, and he's Westerner, but and a lot of this, I was like, this is so close to falling into like almost like sugar sweet sentimentality at times. You know, mm-hmm. this like childhood ideality. This like notions of Eden, like this sort of, you can think of at times, it's like, oh, he's talking about like a village green or something, or like country lanes. Like this is so close to like a sherbet lemon of poetry. But then there's something about it which has like a Western Eastern strangeness, a peculiarity of like, why does writing about this feel so not alien, but you've made something so common different. And I think it is, just to sort of get the conversation going, one thing I noticed immediately, and you'll have to forgive me if I'm basically mentioning the most cliche Blakean ideas here, but seeds of suffering and doubt and harshness thrown into what is like an ecstatic beauty, and all of a sudden you're left with a sense of like positive unease.
That's really interesting. Yeah, and I think maybe this is something that you picked up maybe from looking at the songs of mm-hmm. Innocence Experience. Yeah, and I really, you know, this, I think the songs of Innocence and of Experience is really a moment where Blake is thinking in dualities and in contraries. And you know, he's got this, one of the famous proverbs of hell in The Marriage of Heaven and Hell is, without contraries, there is no progression. So there's a sense in which there isn't really, you know, this kind of sugar sweet innocence. I think if there's an incredible economy to his world of innocence, which intimates that innocence is never really mere innocence, or a kind of innocence that is really a sentimental projection of adults. Mm. I think he's much more aware that innocence is tinged with experience, or has its own very developed mode of knowledge and intelligence. Mm. So there's a kind of, and you know, I think he's true to life in this. I mean, if you witness the way children play, it's extraordinarily serious and developed and coherent. So there's a kind of blissful, joyful coherence to playful children, which intimates that innocence is something far more subtle than this kind of Victorian sentimentality that, or pre-Victorian sentimentality that we can perhaps sense in Blake. And converse, so just as innocence has its kind of extraordinary intelligence, I think conversely, it is possible to travel through the world of experience with a kind of innocence, and discover, as it were, through the travails of experience, a sort of second innocence or second naivete, as Paul Ricoeur puts it. So I think these opposites kind of play into each other, and Blake is constantly and gently, I think, warning us of the kind of seed of the one that is present in the other.
Mm. Well, when I was reading it, it reminded me of, now I may this may be wrong already, this conversation is a bit all over the place for myself, but this may be wrong with respect to Carl Jung's work. So Carl Jung, when he's talking about childhood, he says, like, your first childhood in a way isn't a childhood. Like, this innocence, you need both innocence and experience. You can't just be innocent. You can't know your innocence. Like the idea of the good old days, right? So you don't know the good old days when you're in them. You don't know innocence when you're in it. You also don't know your first childhood when you're in it. So Jung sort of has this idea of, when you become an adult and you have children, you are actually experiencing your proper childhood then with them. And almost, I don't know if he ever went this far, I'm sure he probably did. Grandparents then, it probably becomes even more innocent because they have all that wisdom. They have even more experience. Mm. So they understand the beauty and, like, the fragility of childhood even more. But when you're in it, this was something that came through for me with Blake, is like, you just can't know it when you're in it. And it really gave me this deep, I don't often get affected by literature. There's very few. I'm fairly an emotionless person, to be honest. But it did, it genuinely gave me a feeling of, sort of brought back a lot of memories of a deep realization of, you're not getting those days back, but they were still beautiful. But there's a tragedy in it.
Yes.
Maybe I'm all over the shop.
No. I mean, there is a tragedy in it, in that the awakening to experience is a kind of, is what is represented, say, biblically or mythologically as the fall. Mm-hmm. So there is a kind of entering a world in which things are, divided and alienated. So there's that inevitable loss. But I think there's a seed, despite that fragmentation, there is a seed that can continue to grow. And in a sense, I think Blake is calling, I mean, let's be clear, the songs of innocence and of experience are songs, they're supposed to be easy, simple, direct things that children could sing. So there is that one aspect, but as ever with I think great artists, there are infinite depths even to the simplest of things, and perhaps especially to the simplest of things. But I do think Blake's inviting us to hold contraries together without trying to collapse them into simplistic notions of a fallen adult world that is forever has been wrenched away from the simple joys of childhood, and conversely of a childhood that is this sort of, floating in a kind of formaldehyde, away from any possible contact with anything that could spoil the purity. So in a sense, I think in the songs, there is an invitation to travel a kind of middle road in which those seeming contraries can be held together. And I think within that paradox is where the work of the imagination takes place.
What is the imagination? Might as well crack that one open.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, where does one begin with that? Because in a sense, the imagination is the sort of central revelation of Blake's work, I think. And so there's sort of no easy theory to extract from this kind of magisterial output of Blakean painting and engraving and poetry. And then we can say, okay, this is what Blake means by the imagination. In the same way that you could do perhaps with a Coleridge, who's got this famous statement in his Biographica Literaria, which is kind of Blakean in its way. So I think there's something slightly unsystematic, and perhaps as the conversation unfolds, we can discover what it means together. But certainly what it isn't, then maybe we can start with what it isn't, is a faculty of the mind. As though it's a sort of a fantasy producing kind of aspect of cognition. I think he, at times he says things like God is the imagination, or Jesus the imagination, you know. He describes the imagination as eternity ever expanding in the bosom of God. So, you know, there's these fantastical, poetic, mystical statements that demand to be unpacked. But so, you know, I suppose there's an aspect of the imagination that could be likened to something like mind in the truest possible sense, in its most creative sense, and perhaps away from the slightly cognitive flavors that such a term could have.
So there isn't a personal individual control there.
Well, I think that personality is a development of an awakened imagination. So it is a flow that is greater than any single human faculty in which we all participate. But paradoxically, that participation in this kind of flow of creative imagination, which has a divine source, is itself what gives us our very being. You know, we have our being insofar as we are imaginative, and that is that we create and give form to reality, physical and mental. It's kind of quite grand.
So what happens in a world where we're bereft of that imagination, where it seems to be a bit reciprocal, so the personality doesn't become anything more without imagination, but also I guess the less personality you have, the less imagination, sort of this sort of strange loop with something coming in perhaps from the above, what is called God, which we'll get to. What happens in a world without that imagination?
Well, I mean, insofar as we are in the world, there is a form of imagination at play. So, you know, bidden or unbidden, or seen or unseen, noticed or unnoticed, the imagination is here. So the world that we have, which is a world in which there is a certain very powerful techno-rational form of tyranny, is in fact, I would argue, not the absence of, but a profound distortion of the imagination, or rather one mode of vision, one mode of imaginative vision that has been taken to be, that has been made to control the entire picture, that it has made to be synonymous with the whole of reality, is what Blake calls Newton sleep, or single vision, which is this this kind of tyrannical, uncreative, unprolific, controlling mode that tries to make the infinite into a finite, a docile, and inert world. So that for, I think that for Blake is a fracture in human consciousness. And only those of artistic temperament, by which he also means himself, can really counter that. I think the philosophers and the scientists and the theologians are too late. It's a matter for the artists.
Well, I would disagree on one of them. I disagree on the scientists, but it's because I'm reading a book on quantum physics. But I disagree in a strange way. I disagree because scientists, so you have that classical Newtonian universe of like blocks being moved around, or you can look, that's going to there, there's causation, and then we discovered the quantum or quantum theory, and now it's like we don't really know what's going on. And they don't really want to admit that yet. Scientists, so they're still in the old mode. But I think what we're sort of tiptoeing around here is Blake's relationship with the Enlightenment, which seems to be we were talking earlier about opposites and contraries and sort of this a possible friction, seems to be his own thing that he's constantly pushing against, or maybe battling, or maybe always in discussion with, is this the Enlightenment, with this quantifying world. So what is that for Blake?
Okay. I mean, that's also a very big thing. I think let's just be clear that, I mean, in a sense, you were talking about science and quantum theory as this sort of pushing the boundaries on the Newton sleep without really ever wholly leaving it. I'm by no means an expert, but whenever I talk to my scientist friends or my quantum scientist friends, they talk about all this interesting stuff, and inevitably the language strays into mysticism or philosophy or even art, because at some point that paradigm, if I can use that word, is bankrupt. And there needs to be very, very serious, a very, very serious rediscovery of vision to really begin to come to grips with what is being quote unquote discovered or envisioned or partly created. For Blake, it's always reality is always partly created, partly discovered, right? So, the creative process is the major process. But with the Enlightenment, I mean, I guess, you know, there's been a fair amount of Enlightenment bashing, I think, over the centuries. Mm. And there's, you know, a very simple way of coming at it is obviously that the overemphasis on cognition to the detriment of the imaginative faculty is, I think, where Blake really is unique is that he really perceives the deep interconnection between that as a movement of, say, science and philosophy and its inevitable repercussions in politics, in religion, in morality, in sexuality, in art. He sees all those things as a unified, because the Enlightenment and sort of what preceded it is a kind of, as I said, a sort of fracturing consciousness and a move of the human imagination into that kind of single mode of vision. It has repercussions for every single aspect of human life. So in a sense, it's not just a matter of, you know, correcting the subject-object split. The subject-object split was inevitable once the imagination chose a kind of vision as its supreme master, if you see what I mean. So in a sense, it's not just holding, you know, rationality and cognition as the chief human, you know, the highest human achievements, but it is also a particularly disembodied form of rationality and of cognition that the Enlightenment upholds. And so there's a secret cruelty towards and hatred of the body and its energies, you know, of sensual love and sensual understanding and its energies that comes along with that. So that emphasis on cognition is not value neutral. It has a kind of comportment towards the material and the bodily and the spiritual. I think we're still feeling those effects today.
An unseen excess.
Interesting. I like that. Yeah, I like that. Yeah.
There seems to be an excess in Blake, but it's difficult to see from that position of Newton's leap.
Yes.
Difficult to see from that position, you know, everything's so self-contained and controlled, where an excess would come from. It has to come from somewhere else. So to be very, very abstract and vague, where is it that this peculiar, what I've just called excess, which may be wrong, where's this coming from?
Uh-huh.
If only we knew. But if we knew, we wouldn't know, right?
Mm-hmm.
No one wants to know the mystery, really.
That's true. I mean, I think from Blake's perspective, creativity is this infinite outpouring which comes from the bosom of God and animates everything. And it is perpetually expressing itself and ever, you know, as he says, ever expanding. Mm-hmm. There's already a principle of life which is contrary to the kind of mechanistic universe, which does not want to ever expand. because if the dream is to create an all-encompassing system, this is a system that has no outside. It does not grow any further.
Mm-hmm.
The energy that runs through the system is just an internal charge that guarantees that every little bit of the system is working.
And it's only ever going to wind down.
Right, right. So if we're saying that creativity, that the imagination, which is both human and divine, is this kind of ever-expanding reality, then we're saying that there's something, that excess is a kind of energy that just expands the real, that adds more to the real. That is, you know, so the real is in constant growth through creativity. So this seems like a simple, not nice philosophical kind of truism to throw around, but actually it runs counter to the ideals of the Enlightenment, which is to create a kind of wholly controllable system slash machine, which, as you said, tends towards inertia or kind of like stabilizing harmony. So therefore, everything that is desirous, that, you know, that wants union and procreation and irregularity and the surprise of the new, the delight of intimacy, of bodily presence, is an enemy to that kind of techno-rational nightmare. So Blake's got his finger on the right pulse, I think.
And this comes across, this does come across in his writing, this notion of sort of a strange Blakean temporality there, where to grasp something, to hold onto it in that enlightenment controllable sense, is to lose it basically immediately. You have to sort of allow spontaneity, you have to allow surprise and energy to have its time. Absolutely. To take some, maybe take something, you know, of it into you, but you have to keep moving. And there's too many people now who want to just, you know, to move into like Heraclitus, to step in, you can never step in the same river twice. Like, too many people want to just step in the river and sort of plant their feet, say, no, this isn't changing.
Yes. Exactly. And of course, there's a real, as you said yourself at the beginning of the conversation, there's a real saccharine kind of way of reading that, which is a sort of psycho-spiritual, oh, you know, be free of attachment, you know, which, you know, has its place, and in a way it's true. But I think Blake goes way beyond the personal, way beyond the. I think he sees that that grasping aspect, you know, what he calls the selfhood, as you know, something in which all humans are now involved. We are in that particular river, whether we like it or not. This is the story of our time. And to respond to that is going to take more than mindfulness. It's going to have to be a collective cultural effort.
Well, mindfulness is okay. We could probably stay with that and see what Blake's appreciation of it would be. I mean, mindfulness is, I mean, I hate mindfulness. It disgusts me. And I mean, with that, I have to separate Western mindfulness, which is really bad, and Eastern mindfulness, which I don't think we could probably in the West understand all that much. But the general notion of mindfulness, of like, you sit down and you open your mind, something comes in, you just let it go, or you let it dissipate. To be mindful, it's all very vague and a bit just sort of nonsensical. Yes. There's no vitality there. There's no sort of engagement. Right. There's like, and there is also a non-acknowledgement of, okay, well, if you're letting it go, it's also the question about acting, which interests me, is like, if an actor is always acting, who is it that you come back to when you stop acting, and are they acting, right? So it's like, it's all very well and good being mindful and letting things go, but where are you letting them go from? Like, what is this foundation that you're somehow trying to protect? So this notion of the self, what is Blake doing? Like, he's acknowledging, you know, as we've said, the sort of river that we're all in, the modern moment of the self, the ego, the cold, hard, iron cage of Weber as well. What's Blake doing? What does he want to do with that self? What's being built in that self? How is it being changed? Or am I on the wrong track?
No. I mean, this is great.
it's just very like, you, are we in a Blakean problem ourselves, that we don't want to plant a flag too much?
No, I think so. There's various. I mean, it's such a rich question. So there's various things about the aspect of, you know, the selfhood, what he calls the selfhood, which is this kind of from a very simple point of view, which is that kind of fear-driven ego that is desperately trying to grasp on and control reality, whilst sort of secretly hating it, right? Because as Blake expresses, the human spirit longs, is a naturally infinite being. So anything finite becomes an object of hatred at some point. So there's a very funny thing that occurs in human consciousness, which Blake mythologizes through one of the characters that he creates, Urizen, which you know basically stands for that fallen form of rationality. That at the same time as he longs for that complete control over things, he also weeps, you know, over it, because you know he knows that he's killing something. So there's there are these dual things that are occurring all the time in the soul. It's these contraries that operate together. Anyway, I got lost in a slight cul-de-sac here. What were we talking about? Oh yes, whilst mindfulness, whatever that means, has its problems, as you quite wisely point out. At the same time, there is this thing that Blake talks about when he talks about self-annihilation. And self-annihilation is really a kind of awakening into a kind of dynamic, creative presence to one another. And that is really only possible when that kind of Newtonic nightmare gets, which is also the moral law at the same time for Blake, when that is kind of passed through, then it is actually possible to build a genuine community in which each one of us has their artistic power, their creative energy released to the maximum. So it is actually a form of mindful presence, not in that kind of saccharine let it all go thing, but actually being present so that we can genuinely build what Blake calls Jerusalem.
Can we go too far?
In what way?
Could we engage with that presence too much? Could we go, is there a Blakean madness?
Well, I mean, you know, ever since Plato, I think creativity has been associated with madness. It's a form of sane madness. So there is perhaps a sense in which we could go too far. But I think from Blake's point of view, rather go too far than live a life in slavery to a system and a moral code that is oppressing us. But I think this kind of awakening into presence that I'm talking about is really where the senses, the bodily senses as well as the spiritual senses, are fully awake, and their modes of perception are open enough so that they can grasp the relationship between the finite and the infinite. They can grasp that all finite things are actually translucent with infinity. And that's what the human is called to do. That's its job in the grand scheme of things. And if we've been dulled, through our education, through our politics, through our morality, if we've been dulled to restrict our senses to a very, very small, minute version of the real, which is designed to, keep us buying things and then to die, then we're in big, big trouble.
How do we open to? How do we do that then? How do we open ourselves to the real? Can everyone do it? That's always an important question. Because not everyone's creative.
No, I think people are creative in different ways. I think there are dormant creativities to be awakened for different people in different ways. So not everyone has to be a poet and an artist and an engraver. But I do. From Blake's point of view, it seems to me that whatever an artist is, their business is to awaken the senses and the imagination and the hearts of others to those realities. So there's a connection between art and education in the true sense, from that Blakean perspective. So not everyone's going to go around painting. But those that fortunately or unfortunately have that skill, that's really their task is to do that. So at the same time, you see, you've got this Blakean outrage, right? And I know we were talking before the call about that angry sound that he has, that indignation that drives him. Because really, Blake is minutely aware of the fact that he lives within a form of art that is inherently tyrannical to the human spirit. That's what society is as he sees it. So he, as an artist, has to be driven by perpetual creative discontent. Has no choice. It's not for an aesthetic flourish. It's not decoration. Art is not decoration. It's the revolt of the real against oppression.
What's happened when we've become content? What have we submitted to?
Yeah. Yeah, good question. I mean, I think it's this enslaving mode of vision that ensures that the clock keeps ticking and the machine keeps running. And there's a funny alliance between morality, religion, politics, that sort of ensures that prison keeps working and its walls keep looking like they're golden, so that everybody feels like, well, no, I'm a liberated individual. I'm not in a prison at all. Mm. And that's the complex system of human culture that has sort of turned against itself. And unless we wake up to that, we will be, you know, kind of content and sort of die a sleepy death.
Sleepy death.
Sleep. There's a lot in there.
I like metaphors around sleep and being awake. They work. Mm-hmm. They work well. But I guess we should bring in the other aspect and peculiar aspect of Blake's work. Where does, and I'll put it in quotation marks, where does God fit in all this? Because Blake's God is peculiar.
Mm. And what way do you find God peculiar in Blake?
Well, I think I most enjoyed Proverbs of Hell. Mm. And I think, you know, and undoubtedly Blake is... would be considered by traditional dogmatic theologians of all most stripes to be a heretic and definitely, like, emphatically unorthodox and definitely a heretic. And but it's almost like a radical heresy, you know, this emphasis on sexuality, this emphasis on, I mean, even just the creativity itself is almost a relationship with creation, which is meant to be in excess above creation, almost like God has created something. And then Blake says, like, wow, you know what? I'm going to go beyond that. And we're going to, as creations, we're going to try usurp, maybe that's the wrong word, but yeah, usurp our creation itself and find some excess which wasn't given to us. And there's almost like a...
Yeah, yeah.
What do you call it? Not a frustration. And I don't think he's angry at God, but he's angry at something. There's just this, like, almost like a disappointment. Like, this could be so much more. And so perhaps he sees himself as, like, the next step and just, well, I'm taking it to its extreme. But
No, that's so interesting. Well, by the way, the other day I was having a conversation with an eminent British theologian, mm-hmm. who's very sympathetic to Blake. Mm-hmm. And he just casually dropped that remark. And he said, you know, a lot of people say that Blake is a heretic, but no one's ever proven how or why. So everyone assumes that his Christianity is heretical, but actually it's never been consistently put together, a case against Blake. So that's, you know, okay.
Maybe no one wants to, I certainly wouldn't want a theologian to put a case against Blake though, right?
No.
It would fall flat immediately. Yeah. You wouldn't, I don't care about it. Blake, who's going to win against
exactly.
Blake?
Exactly. Yeah, no, absolutely. But I mean, yeah, so many interesting things in what you said. I mean, there's obviously what God isn't, maybe we can start with that, which is what one picks up in The Marriage of Heaven and Hell, is this figure, the angry old man, the sort of the policeman in the sky, bloodthirsty policeman in the sky, I might add, who Blake elsewhere calls old Nobo Daddy. And I think that expression "Nobo Daddy" is an excellent mixture of kind of Freudian and other sort of symbolism, but very perceptive. So this idea that this angry old dude is somehow, you know, can't wait to punish us for any possible kind of trespass of his inflexible and mean-spirited law. And that's the conception of God that for Blake is false religion. For Blake, God is Jesus. And so Jesus has an eminently and intimately human face.
Mm.
So that means that the divine is really kenotic, you know, that there's that the what's at the heart of the divine is a giving of itself away into this outflow of creativity and imagination and love. So, you know, as you know, there's this famous anecdote about Blake that he was asked what he thought of Jesus, and he answered, "He is the only God, and so am I, and so are you." So I think that's a really useful way of engaging with what, you know, what God is for Blake. So there isn't an other higher tyrannical figure that reigns over us. And that's maybe why some people have difficulty with Blake's version of Christianity. Mm. But because of the incarnation of Jesus, all that stuff's gone away. And now God inhabits, which means also is, the human imagination. Mm. And so the more truly creative we are, the more we participate in God's being. And ultimately, the creations of the imagination are in eternity. They form this kind of gigantic person, which is this kind of cosmic body of Christ. Mm. So it's a very, so I think that would play into Blake's notion of God. But, you know, in a sense, the divine sort of longs for us to see the creation as it sees it. You know, with the, you know, as it says at the beginning of Genesis, you know, that God sees all things as good. So in a sense, when the imagination is fully working, we're kind of seeing the infinite goodness that flows through all things. And so we're participating in this divine outpour, this divine flow.
So could that goodness be synonymous with like that, an excess energy? Because this mm-hmm. in Marriage of Heaven and Hell is great little quote, energy is eternal delight. So there's this energetic undercurrent for Blake.
Yeah.
But I don't think, you know, it's clearly not the Newtonian energy of atoms and quarks or whatever. It's something more. And so is energy and goodness, are they one of the same?
That's a really good question. So in The Marriage of Heaven and Hell, so Blake has this amazing thing that he falls out with the people he loves. Because as he says, opposition is true friendship. So Marriage of Heaven and Hell started out as a creative protest against Swedenborg, you know, and Swedenborg had written these tomes of, he's really interesting. Perhaps you should do an episode on Swedenborg.
I'm reading stuff. This is on the list. Swedenborg at the moment.
Yeah. Well, there you go. So, you know, Blake was deeply inspired by the kind of Swedenborgian revelations, angelic visions, and all these kind of connections that Swedenborg was making. But at the same time, he was becoming increasingly frustrated with the fact that the Swedenborgian angels seemed to be speaking a very conventional Protestant form of morality.
And the heaven and Swedenborg's heaven and hell are the most anthropocentric,
right?
Sitting around drinking cocktails, right? Like, come on, really? Like, if that's exactly. heaven, I don't. If that's heaven and hell, I don't want to go to either, because it's like I can't imagine anything worse than an eternity of this. Yeah. Like, however good your material worldly life is, if it's eternal, it's not going to end up being good. That's like being on a cruise ship for eternity, right? That's hell.
Either. Absolutely. And therefore, the really interesting, juicy stuff, if I may put it this way, in Marriage of Heaven and Hell is the hell stuff.
Mm.
Because Blake then turns the tables and decides to speak in that kind of demonic voice. The voice of the devil becomes the interesting, it becomes the voice of energy, which refuses to be subsumed by this facile cocktail drinking morality that you describe. If morality can be seen as drinking cocktails, I'm not sure. So I think in the Marriage of Heaven and Hell, there is this thing about energy versus reason. And this is a kind of duality that Blake explores in other ways in his later work. But energy is eternal delight is one of those, one of the ways I like to think of that one. Mm. Is energy is the delight of eternity. Mm-hmm. That eternity, i.e. the divine, i.e. God, delights at energy. And anything that is so... Behind that, there's the intuition that a true unbounded action is already good and true and beautiful. And what drives our actions astray is the fact that we stop. Mm. We stop true desire. We push back on it. We restrict energy to certain forms of lesser vision.
Mm.
We don't allow energy, it's spontaneous outflow. So a true action is just the expression of this infinite energy. So that means it has to come from a kind of true desire, not a weird, disconnected or thwarted kind of desire.
So it seems like Blake would be averse to any afterlife, which is like done, like you're in heaven, done, you're in hell, done, right? Like these are, however bad or good they are, they seem, the traditional versions of heaven and hell seem very stagnant. Did he have his own beliefs of where we go, or was he just not?
Well, you know what I'm going to say, that the whereness and the whenness are not really true eternity. Mm-hmm. So in a sense, those are interesting questions, but it is possible, I think, from a Blakean perspective, to live in eternity now.
Mm-hmm.
And participation in the imagination is being in the golden, is being in Eden, is being in golden eternity right now. So in a sense, I mean, there are, you know, from a biographical point of view, he is supposed to have said at the end of his life, you know, something like, I'm going back to this country that I've always wanted to see. I wanted to see all my life. But at the same time, there is no afterlife in time. There is this afterlife in eternity, as it were. Mm. Because apocalypse for him is eternal revelation rather than the end of the finite world, which would yet turn out to be another finite event.
Was there pushback against Blake in terms of this, his own, I guess you could call it, his own theology? Or was
During his time?
Yeah, during his time, yeah.
Oh, I mean, I don't think, I mean, he was so not considered during his day. I don't think people bothered to push back. I think he lived his life in relative, he was not well known. And even the people who loved him, you know, towards the end of his life, he had this circle of people who thought he was a saint, basically, these artists, these young artists who called themselves the ancients, paradoxically. And they would follow him around and marvel at some of his artwork, but also at his kind of countenance and the sort of simple beauty of his being.
Mm-hmm.
But they deplored his theological ideas. You know, they couldn't go with him all the way with that kind of stuff. But ever since, I think all kinds of people have. I mean, you know, he was seen as mad in the decades following his life.
Do you think he was, or do you think that's contextual data?
No, I don't think he was mad. I think he was extraordinarily sane. But as we said before, I think there's a point in which sanity and madness meet. I think one thing he wasn't was diplomatic. So I don't think he could dilute his ideas in a way that made them palatable for others. I think there was a, particularly perhaps in his younger days, there was a spirit and an urgency. You picked it up as well. It's kind of,
and there's a density to it.
Yes,
in just a few lines, there's like this sort of rich fudge cake.
Rich fudge cake.
It's almost like I can't, you know. I mean, I read what you recommended, then read some more. But there's almost this like I can't read anymore. Almost like I can't eat any more of that. I can't read any more of that today.
Yeah. Yes,
it's just a few words, and your brain's sort of like, right, I've got to make my way through this meal. but you also can't attend to it as we've been talking about. You can't. It's like as soon as you begin to attend to it with a certain type of rationality or reason or deconstruction or context, it's just like, it's not the same thing anymore. I just have to sort of sit and let that simmer for a bit.
Absolutely. I mean, that's really interesting you say that. I mean, the ultra theoretical readings of Blake are not going to be all that helpful. I think that there is, first of all, it's important to remember that I think all his art is meant to be seen as a kind of complete interdisciplinary, if I can use that horrible term, output, so that you are exposed to these illuminated writings and you are taking in the coloring, the way that it's written, the painting aspect of it, the draw, everything has to be together. But the experience has to be complete in that sense. But also in another way, I think he is encouraging the reader to slow down. I think there's a push against a kind of deadened way of reading. I think all of us have, and in his day, because poetry had, you know, I call it skill and ethics. So basically poetry in his day was, you know, an aptitude with rhetoric and, you know, and imagery and the kind of morality that you uphold. You know, and for him, that's absent-minded. That's a Newton sleep way of reading poetry, where the mind just runs on ahead to find the information. So I think because his writing is so dense, he is inviting the reader to slow down and contemplate what has just been uttered. And this is in the Songs of Innocence and Experience, which are deceptively simple, and in his later prophetic work, which is incredibly complicated. But I think in both cases, he's asking us to consider with our own imagination. He's in a way assuming that we're doing the imaginative work along with him rather than passively absorbing. So maybe he shouldn't have assumed that, particularly with these prophetic books, because I think he overestimated the reader there. But yeah, there's definitely that fudge cake like density, I think, is an invitation to attention, yeah, to listening.
How has he affected your life? How has his work affected your life? Do you feel you have Blakean moments?
Yes, I do. I think what I am, if I can use that kind of outworn phrase, what I'm seeking in life, and I've sought it through philosophy, through religion, through, in a sense, Blake is because of his kind of profound allegiance to creativity. And to this kind of dynamic, ever unfolding imagination, I think I keep on returning to the way he approaches reality, because it just has an energy that philosophy or spirituality or all these other things don't quite have. So yeah, I would say he's a sort of lifelong friend in that sense, and I keep on returning to him. But I also think, that there are very deep, you know, philosophical truths and artistic truths that we have not yet grasped about Blake. I don't think it's that easy to get to grips with him. And so I think he's eminently important for our time.
What do you think his work can help within our time? What can we take from him? What do we need to take from him?
Well, okay. I mean, look, for example, I mean, I can't remember if this was before or during the call, but we talked about AI and the kind of omnipresence of AI, which is the latest manifestation of this kind of fracture, discord in consciousness, in the imagination. And in a way, I think those of us that are trying to approach it as discrete phenomena, you know, oh, here's, oh, what a shame, we're a little bit too rational. Oh, you know, there's not enough place for the emotion. And, oh, there's a bit of AI where I guess we need to think about the ethics around that. Like, we're approaching all these things as though they were discrete phenomena, but actually they are all part of a sort of spiritual, imaginal development in human consciousness that I think only a kind of mythical approach like Blake, or a poetical approach like Blake, can tackle, because if you tackle it in this way, you do not use the same tools that have created the problem in the first place, which is this disembodied techno-rational form of cognition. So whilst I applaud very cogent forms of, you know, deconstruction and post-human kind of thinking that try to push back, they ultimately don't really go far enough. They end up espousing the same, they dance the same dance. They espouse the same logic as that of their enemy. I really do think we need to get back to the mythic and the poetic and the artistic to get our way out of here.
But we're pretty much sort of like need to exercise the parasite of hyper reason and rationality, because we can't attend to the mythic and the poetic in our current state.
No, but what Blake, if you follow Blake seriously, you do realize that it's not fanciful human creation. It is the alphabet of reality. And so I think a reminder of that and an invitation to follow that thread that Blake gives us is enough to start in that direction. And also, it also relieves this weird pressure that we put on finding the culprit, you know, this kind of mode of scapegoating. It's like, well, who's doing this? You know, is it, you know, the dark forces, or, you know, whatever, Elon Musk, or, you know, Big Pharma, whatever, you know, it's so, you know, whoever, pick your enemy. I think Blake's not interested in that. I think there's a collective responsibility that expands in time and space that is 3, 4, 5, maybe 1,000 years old, maybe even older, that is part of human culture. And to address that is a formidable task. And I think Blake's a good ally in that particular, what he calls, mental fight.
Do you think he's had the fame which is sort of deserving of him? Do you think he's known to the level you feel he should be?
I think so. I think, because his work is so multi-leveled, there's people approach him at all kinds of levels, you know, whether they chant Jerusalem absentmindedly, or whether, you know, artists like, I don't know, Kay Tempest or Patti Smith or Allen Ginsberg, you know, I mean, this is an interesting thing as well, is that Blake inspires figures that are very conservative and very radical, you know. So there's a kind of generosity and a kind of multivocal dimension to his work that so many people are finding points of entry. So on the one hand, I think he has this incredible fame. On the other hand, I think we haven't really begun to scrape the surface. So that's, you know, there's plenty to do there.
Why do we begin there? Where would you advise people to begin?
I think I'd probably, I would go with Songs of Innocence and of Experience and Marriage of Heaven and Hell. I think Blake's, even though he kind of keeps on developing, he's also incredibly consistent. And he's, you know, his first, there's two or three, no, two All three. There's one, there are pamphlets that he begins his kind of artistic career with. One called All Religions Are One. And there is another one in two versions called There Is No Natural Religion. And if you go to those, they're very short, but it's coherent. You find the same thoughts in very different forms, expressed very differently and far more imaginatively at the end of his life. So I think there's a sort of, there's a vision that he received early on, and his life was an outpouring of that and a development of that. So the early work, I think, is a safe and perhaps slightly easier way to approach Blake.
And you're currently working on a book on Blake.
I'm hoping so. I mean, I am currently working on it. And it's a big, you know, it's a big, it's a Blakean theory, if I can call it that, of nature and culture. So it's a sort of thinking about the relationship between the natural and the imaginative. And, you know, especially in the light of recent sort of post-human ecology and all those kinds of things. So I'm sort of writing a Blakean response to all that kind of stuff. That's what it looks like at the moment. Work in progress.
I look forward. Hopefully one day I'll be reading it. Is there anything you'd like to add about William Blake?
No, I think that's it for the moment. That's it for the moment, yeah.
Okay. Valentin Gallet, it's been a great conversation. Thanks very much.
Thanks, James.